Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of environmental health, food policy, and science, also covering the media, popular attitudes, and the tremendous shifts that are going on in our world, which, you know, just keep getting more and more, of a greater and greater magnitude. So one of the things that we do here on Connect the Dots is that I provide a platform for people, influencers, thought leaders, advocates, and people who really are holding important pieces and sectors of information that really can help guide us and guide the direction of our country so that we are protecting ourselves, our health, the health of future generations, and the health of our habitat. And that's really the goal of this show. And so every week we talk with different people who do that. And the overall goal is really to provide a place where you listeners can come to, you know, where like-minded people listen, also joining myself and many of our guests in our other online platforms and advocacy efforts so that our voices can be unified and effective in a time of great change. I'm thrilled today to have with me on the show, in a returning appearance, Rachel Marco Havens, who also was an earlier guest on this program, whom you may have heard and is now back to tell us something really fascinating and interesting about her recent journey to Standing Rock as part of the NoDAPL, that means No Dakota Access Pipeline, effort and uprising, and she'll be telling us more about that. Let me tell you first a little bit about Rachel. She's a multi-platform solutionary artist, love that, performer, creative entrepreneur, and community organizer working primarily with transformation, with a strong focus on women's leadership, youth empowerment, and bridging intergenerational connections. Rachel seeks to close the gaps in social, environmental, and spiritual justice movements. I love that. It's so important not to, just to kind of, you know, there's a place for people who are powerful advocacy voices on a single or you know, cross-reaching issue, but it's also extremely important to connect the different groups so that for the limited time and you know, energy that people can devote to activism, you know, there's a place to concentrate and there's a place to join efforts and collaborate. And so I, being a bridge myself, I am a great believer in bridge, the bridge function and bridge people, like Rachel Marco Havens. Currently, Rachel works with the protection of the waters of the Hudson Valley as one of the board of directors for the Hudson River SLU, Clearwater, and she's also a youth engagement director for Earth Guardians and is fostering the expansion of young leaders in the New York chapter. So, you know, welcome back to Connect the Dots, Rachel. You know, I look forward in our first show just for listeners, you know, who haven't heard it, you can find it in the Connect the Dots archives, which you find by Googling Connect the Dots and Podbean. Or if you join either of us, Rachel or myself, on Facebook or both, there are also links on those pages as well as my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots. You know, the first show, we really laid the groundwork talking about Rachel's background, and I share that background too, in organizing against, you know, pipelines in the Northeast. And that show is really notable and is a great listen because, you know, I just actually, stuff that we discussed on the show, I just was able to use in an interchange with someone who was kind of putting down grassroots activism, saying, oh, well, they're only protecting, you know, whatever is in their own backyard kind of thing. If a pipeline or a fracking site or a nuclear power plant came to town, they just don't want it there. You know, well, of course, nobody wants it there. But the motto of our movement has always been in nobody's backyard. And Rachel brilliantly in the earlier program really connected the dots by connecting all the pipelines. So wherever grassroots efforts are happening in regard to one pipeline. They're actually speaking for all pipelines because all these pipelines are actually interconnected. You know, they go about getting their approvals community by community, but the end result is that they'll crisscross the country and the globe, as Rachel brilliantly articulated in our earlier program. So, you know, so actually, Rachel took the time and had the ability to travel out to Standing Rock, which is really the signature happening of this year and this century and this epoch, really, in terms of not only showing the numbers of people and the ecological centers that, you know, where this contamination and destruction of Earth occur, but really in uniting people and bringing them together so that it's very much for the global community. I would call the No Dapple Uprising, the Standing Rock Uprising, the signature event. And it's been underreported in the media. And so I'm really thrilled today to have Rachel Marco Havens with us to take us along in retrospect on her journey, her recent journey there. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Allison. It's so good to be here again. Take you on the journey. It's been a journey. It's still a journey. That's what's so fascinating about a trip like this for me, is actually reconnecting back here, landing at home, and trying to process all of that experience. So I feel really fortunate to be able to share it with you in such a way. And where should we start?
Well, let's just start with what you drove out to Standing Rock. When did you actually go there? Like, what was the duration of your visit there? How long were you there?
I spent about, I think it was 8 or 9 days, and I planned to go for 5, and I got in my car, and I drove, and I went really with many of the prayers of the local community. As you had mentioned, we're here working on several different pipelines and storage facilities, et cetera, in the New York region. And I went by myself. Some of my mentors said, you know what, we want to make sure you can go. You're going. And so they sponsored my trip. I didn't, it wasn't like I was like, I'm going to go. It was like, no, you're going to go. So I had to pack and be ready and get, you know, be ready to go. So I headed out, and it was a strange day because it was actually the, I think it was either the 9th or the 14th. It was the day that we were all sort of sitting in wait for the judge to make his decision in D.C. regarding an injunction that had been filed by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. So as I was driving out, we were waiting to hear the answer as to whether or not they were going to stop this pipeline or not. So it was the day that the joint statement was released, which was, I think, the 9th of...
Right. Well, that's a kind of minor detail. But let's just, you know, when you... So you were driving out as this court decision was hanging overhead. When you got there, you know, what was it like? Was it different from what you imagined? Was there a difference in being there versus, you know, we've all seen... you know, many pictures and you know, and listened to videos and read and, you know, all of that. You know, what...
There was a few differences. There was a lot... There was several differences. I mean, one, it's very difficult to watch something like this on your computer screen. And I say computer screen because there's pretty much a media blackout on the issue in mainstream media. And know that this incredible thing is happening and actually feel it, because I think people who are sensitive can feel that energy. But when you drive down, the experience just got more and more humble. I was more humbled as I got closer. So about 10 miles out from Cannonball Ranch, you go through a checkpoint. And that just that experience alone, driving up to this checkpoint, and you know that it's the National Guard. You don't really know what's going on to the up to the date and to the moment. As best as they can, people are getting the word out. But service is spotty. So I'm driving down the road, and I'm like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, what are they going to do? And my car is, of course, full of provisions and donations, so there's no, like, oh, I'm just going to my friend's house, you know. So I'm driving down the road. They waved me through. They likely took my license plate, but they waved me through. And as you get closer, and because the landscape is so dramatic, the experience is absolutely tremendous when you see the first camp. There was, I think it might still be a little bit happening, one camp called Sacred Base Camp, which is, as many people heard when the dogs were brought in, Dapple was digging in an area that was unprecedented because they hadn't been there yet, and it had just been announced to be a sacred site. So they just rolled in and dug into the sacred site, and they brought dogs. And that site is the first thing you see when you're coming from north. And it's about, mm-hmm. it was about 10 tents and a small group of people just holding space to make sure that, you know, people weren't getting a little too wild and going onto the sacred site or crossing into trespassing territory, and just holding space and reminding everyone that we are here. So then you drive another mm-hmm. mile and a half, and this field, a prairie, opens up, and it's on your left. I was on my left, and I looked to the left, and it was like, oh, I'm here. This is an encampment of major proportions. The entire field was dappled, and in many places, excuse the pun, many places was very thick with people. And I mm-hmm. arrived at about 6:30, so the sun was going down. I wasn't really sure where I was going to land, and I pulled into camp, and I said, is this Sacred Stone Camp? And they said, no, that's up over the hill. This is Red Warrior Camp. And I'm like, wow, Red Warrior Camp got pretty big, man. Okay, so I keep going. So there's several different sort of camps, and they almost mimic the jobs everyone's doing, right? So the Red Warrior Camp is handling a lot of frontline direct action, nonviolent direct action. And I knew that. And so I said, okay, and I putter in, and I drive into the reservation and over some hills, and I had to kind of dig to get by car to Sacred Stone Camp, which was a very small camp, the original encampment that had been set up when there was a decision that this pipeline wasn't coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And I dropped off my provisions because there I was like, well, that's the original camp, but I have a friend and she's back in the other camp. So I dropped off some provisions and vowed to go back there, or told myself I'd end up back there. And I went back to the main camp, which turned out to be the Osseti Shekoan camp, which is the Seven Councils camp, which was basically the main camp. And way in the back is the Red Warrior camp. So basically, this Osseti Shekoan camp is really it's maintained basically by the council for Standing Rock. And it's everybody's there. Now, if you were just like coming with a tourist attitude, which many people did, native mm-hmm. and non-native, you'd be like, whoa, this is a festival. Like, that's what it felt like when you first look. But as you begin to peel the layers away, you see a whole a community, a small city growing before your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Wow. And so where did you stay? I mean, what was it like to, you know, actually be there? Because I know, you know, the reason I ask this is that I think many people kind of feel a longing to go, can't imagine what it would really be like, don't know if it's truly possible, don't want to be a burden by attending, but, you know, mm-hmm. are feeling a call. So I think just even, and given that you're such a storyteller, I think even just getting some of that on the ground information of what it's actually like is, you know, is really important for people.
Well, you know, I'll preface that with you brought up this sort of people don't necessarily want to step on toes and they don't want to be an intrusion. And I felt that strongly. When I drove in, was like, I don't want to be the colonizer circling camp, you know?
Right.
Somebody, give me some names. Give me some place to land. Because I don't know what's going to happen when I get there. I'm traveling alone. So by the time I got to the main camp, because I got lost on the res, it was dark. So now I'm entering this camp in the dark. And I turned, you know, I pulled up to the gate and they waved me and they were very nice and they asked me some questions about drugs and alcohol and weapons, and which I had none of. And then there was a second station and the woman there said, oh, you know, what are you doing? You're camping? You need to park over here. And she pushed me, she put me in a little parking lot area. Well, I mean, it was all grass, but, and I said, and I'm thinking, okay, like, because it is night, I can't just drive around. So I parked my car and I got out and I started to look for my friend who I couldn't access because there's no phone service, miraculously. I think we think they scrambled the service there. So I'm sort of wandering around and there's smoke coming from many fires. There's a microphone up at the top of the hill where the center fire is and the kitchen and the council is sort of invited, is accepting guests, and people are coming from all over. And I just kind of walked right in straight for this magnanimous teepee, the Seven Council Fires teepee that was in the center of the space. And I was slightly nervous. I was very, my equilibrium was off there because I was like, what do I do? Where do I land? What's going on? It's dark. I guess I'll just sleep in my car and make that easy for night one, and then I'll, you know, set up a camp. And I was greeted by an incredible rancher. His name was James Sunny Bear, and his horse called me, and he says, come sit down. And he and his buddy are sitting there, and they're drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, and they said, have a seat. And we told our stories, and he welcomed me in such a way that was so precious. He said, you can stay in my teepee. I sleep in my... you know, up in my, with my horse up in the, you know, up in the horse trailer. And I didn't accept that, but I accepted that gift and I accepted his offer and this really welcoming space. But as I sort of went, after I left him and I went a little deeper, I got by the fire. I heard the dancers and the singers and the drummers, and I just enveloped myself in this prayer that was happening. And then and then you could hear a hip hop group in the back. And I was like, the hip hop, like, it really did feel like a small festival. And I didn't go any deeper. I listened to the singers for a while, and I went back to my, I was tired. I had driven, took 3 days to get there from here with sleeping and resting a little bit. And I just climbed into my car and I went to sleep. And in the morning, and this guy says to me, are you going to be parked here? Because I sleep next to my van and I'd love for nobody to run over me. So if you're there, that's great. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, the wind just started blowing, and the wind blows on that prairie like there's no – the only thing that changes is the direction. It doesn't – at this point, my time there, it didn't gust. It wasn't like a gusty wind. It was just a straight, steady, constant wind. And I woke up in the morning peeking out of my – I peeked out of my – the back of my car window, and there was – a teepee to the left and a teepee to the right and some tents over here, and the wind was still blowing. And I said, wow, like, where am I? I don't even, so I pull out of my car and I open the door, and there was actually a porta potty servicing truck right there. Immediately, first thing in the morning, and I was thinking, wow, because that was a big thing for me, was thinking about the porta potties and how many people and who wants to do that for a week, you know? But, you know, because I'd rather go in the woods or dig a hole or have an outhouse or, you know, something. So it opened up to, as everyone woke up, it was like young and mostly young people on horses. There was the drums started, the fire started, the welcoming began, and yet I still recognized this this sense of native and non-native, which I expected, which is why I kind of was like, I need to know a lot of people that I can connect with when I get there. There's definitely a sense of native and non-native, and I don't have a problem with that. Some people do. Some people say, well, I showed up, I came here, I brought all this stuff, I brought provisions, and I thought it was going to be like a rainbow gathering, and everyone's going to just invite me into their sweat lodge, and I was going to be, you know, swirling and stage, and it's going to be great. And in actuality, there is a clear and present distance, not with everybody, not in a negative or angry way. It's just a clear and present distance, because your average American doesn't live their life in prayer, and maybe your average Indian may not, your native person may not. You know, maybe they're not traditionalists, but there's something that resides in the heart of Native people that we've either never touched or lost, you know, at birth. So there's a clear difference. You can tell. Like, if I had straighter hair, I have darker skin, I have Native blood on both sides, and there is, you know, if whatever drop of blood in your body is Native, you're Native. You know, some people believe that. But there's a clear and present space where there needs to be a respect that is worn beyond on your sleeve, like right on your forehead, like a big R, you know, the scarlet R, the red R, that says, I respect your space. I respect your tradition. I'm not just here to document your exotic nature. And I had planned to go document. I wanted to get photos and stories and, you know, follow up. And as soon as I got there, I mean, I took some pictures, but they're like wide range landscapes, you know, like I just didn't have that nature to come in with my camera. And you could see people running with their cameras and going with their cameras everywhere. And I didn't want to be that person. And because I saw them, I was like, oh, I don't have to document this. They are. It's happening. Mm-hmm. There is documentation of this happening. And so there's children and moms and ceremony and young men on horses and periodic showmanship, horsemanship events and periodic little race here, there. There's circles coming together, the women's circle. There was a two-spirit camp, which is in our world, we call it the gay and lesbian, transgender bi community. There was a women's camp. But none of it was like, ooh, let's put a sign and tell people that we're the women's camp. Like, you have to let go of all of that need for, like, road signs. You got to let go of that and the need to be guided. You have to figure out how to guide yourself in this community. So very interesting place, because people really did come. There's a lot of people came for the experience. And that's a big one, because there really is there was a purpose for being there. And one thing that happens is that it is a little bit separated, because they're not, you know, when people look at the news and they say, oh man, there was an action and they rolled in with militarized police and there was a ton, they're not rolling into the main camp. These are, the main camp is basically the quote unquote safe zone. While it's not technically Standing Rock property, it is owned, I think, by the Army Corps of Engineers. That's the safe zone. The actions that are being taken at this point are about 20 miles off site, because they did, you know, Obama did request that they stopped construction 20 miles in either direction of Standing Rock or of this point. And but this is a protection zone that is not about just your backyard, as you mentioned. This is a protection zone that says, stop this pipeline. Yes, it's going next to our backyard, which you guys were very careful not to go through our backyard after Winona LaDuc put, you know, Enbridge through the ringer, because how are you going to go through tribal lands and through tribal food sources? This is about stopping this pipeline. This pipeline is 72 miles, I think it's 72 miles shorter than the Keystone XL. It's the same pipeline. So this is about stopping this pipeline, not just the part where they're going through our backyards. So these actions that are happening all the way down to Illinois, actually. All along that line, there are solidarity actions happening. And then, so there's like actions are taken from that camp. So
let me ask you a question.
You're not seeing police there.
Rachel, let me ask you a question, please. Let's step back and just if you could give an explanation for people who might be tuning in and unfamiliar as to what the problem is with the pipeline, why people oppose the pipeline, you know, what is the problem with the pipeline?
So there's plenty of reasons to oppose a pipeline, this particular pipeline and this particular fight. I don't like to say fight, but this particular situation is based on this pipeline was slated to cross the Missouri River up above Bismarck, and they decided that it was a little too risky for the water source, so they moved it down mm-hmm. to 1 mile away from the Standing Rock Sioux Nation's water in their reservation, and crossing between their water intake valve and the river. So if it were to burst in that area, it would take out their water and everyone downstream. What's happening on a bigger level is that we're seeing an industry grappling for relevance in a time when we know that we need to move towards renewable energy now. We can't pull another drop of oil out of the ground, particularly and here in America or anywhere else, but certainly here in America, if we're going to try to reach some goals, like the goals at COP21, at the climate talks, we can't do that. We've already exceeded that. So the more we take these pipelines, we're taking the tar sands, the oil out of the Bakken fields, we're fracking the entire country, and then we're traveling it via pipelines, rails, barges, and actually they're storing quite a bit of it, which is what's happening here in New York. They're storing it, they're holding it, they're moving it around the country so that they can export it. And we keep hearing, well, you guys need heating oil, you need heating oil. We're good on heating oil. We actually don't need more. And they're not bringing it to us. Most of this oil, from what we see, is going to export. So it's bigger than there's, mm-hmm. and if you look around the country, right, how many pipelines have burst and are exploding just in the last, I think it's 300 leaks in the Dakotas alone this year.
Mm-hmm.
These pipelines are not safe. It's not like, oh, we made a pipe and it's like it doesn't have a hole in it from here to Timbuktu. No, they're short. What are they, 15 feet each segment or something? These 20 feet, they're not. They have seals supposedly on them, but we're rushing. Here in the AIM pipeline, they rushed our union workers here 7 days a week, 10 hours a day through that heat wave this summer. Those guys are exhausted, and they're saying, well, we lose $500,000 every day. You don't work, so just keep working. So it's
mm-hmm.
a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major
sure
issue, and it's a right, it's corporate gain. It's not like this is for the people, and the jobs that they promise in these communities, they're fleeting. It's not like, oh, here's a job for the rest of my life. It's not job creation. It's gig creation. You know, you get a gig,
yeah.
And then you
know, I just want to interject with that, because one of the things that I've been covering over the past few weeks is the recent WikiLeaks, which hacked into the emails of John Podesta, who's a campaign manager and longtime ally and manager and works very closely with Hillary Clinton. And one of the things that emerged from one of the emails actually supports exactly your point. They had a kind of a background memo for developing talking points, and they said that energy industry build-outs and jobs such as this pipeline, fracking pipelines, and all the rest of it should always be characterized as careers in order to appeal to the labor movement and, you know, laborers, because if they're called jobs, then it actually reveals the truth, which is, as everyone knows that looks at the industry, these are gigs. They're migrant workers who travel around. They have man camps. They prey on local women. You know, this is not families moving into a community with long-term careers to work on a pipeline. This is all itinerant work, you know, traveling round and round, being in and out of employment, and once this segment is built, then the job is done. So actually, in these recent leaks, they're actually trying to cover up the known situation of the industry, which you just perfectly describe. So I just wanted to interject that. And that's probably, I haven't even seen any press at this time, you know, about that, because, you know, these leaks are still being explored and analyzed by journalists, you know, and that's a tiny one that pertains to our topic today. But, you know, when people can kind of pull back from the horrible Trump drama of the moment, you know, that's that, you know, reporters are actively looking at that, and that's one of the things that's in there. So kind of misleading people about what comes from doing this. Mm-hmm.
It's a big one, and that's one of the things that reminded me, you know, that I was reminded when I got there is all of these pipelines, the pipeline to prison, the pipeline to murder missing and women and girls, the pipelines to black tar heroin. This kind of a pipeline brings a very sick nature to these communities. So, you know, man camps. You mentioned man camps. I mean, what a frightening concept. Thousands of men together in, like, you know, trailer longhouses with isolated, and then there's girls missing regularly in these communities, but no one's paying attention to the native missing women and girls. Well, not no one, mm-hmm. but certainly not the industry or our government. So, you know, that's a frightening thing. And I came across an article, which I periodically post, as I've been posting a lot of this news, because people are watching, but they still can't figure out where to look. I follow the Sacred Stone Camp on Facebook. I follow Red Warrior Camp. I follow the International Indigenous Youth Council, and some of those crossover, but I follow Roberto Barrero. I follow people who are paying attention. I follow Candy Mossett. There's a few people that are important to follow, but I found this article, 5 Things Every Non-Native Needs to Consider Before Visiting Standing Rock. And this woman mm-hmm. wrote it in. I have to say, it's very important read. I'll give you a short synopsis, but behave as an ally. You're there to do service for the people of Standing Rock Sioux Nation as they protect their water, their lives from the Dakota Access Pipeline. They are not there to be your hosts, cultural guides, tourist attractions, misery porn, or to bolster your career or help you earn street cred in the activist community. This woman is awesome. You know, we're not helpless downtrodden Native Americans that need a white savior. Understand the historical context of DAPL and respect the need for Native autonomy, space, and spirituality. And that was that's a big one. It was a big one. You know, it is this extraction industry has an especially devastating impact on Native people. And so, you know, it's really important to kind of sit back and, like, let people do their – why do you need to roll in with a camera and take a picture of a prayer ceremony? Just be there. And that was a big one. You know, follow the instructions of tribal leadership and Native people. If you're here to protect the water, you need to be willing to risk lawsuit. Take supplies for yourself, those that travel with you, and for the camp. So that's another big one if people are thinking of going out there, and especially during the winter. You know, we're getting to winter. Let's see how many people want to travel there. But I brought, you know, 8 gallons of water. I brought enough, you know, try to make sure I had food, or drive to a store. If you don't have food there, it's not that far. You can leave. But this, you know, there's provisions coming in. There's a kitchen that's running, that's supporting thousands of people, really hundreds of people. A lot of people cook for themselves, but there's this sort of notion, like, I'm just going to get in my car with no money and drive to Standing Rock, and I'm going to support, and I'm going to get there, and I'm going to, you know, make my movie or do my...
Mm-hmm.
And
so what did you actually do when you were there? I mean, like, what was it that you would be doing or participating in on a daily basis?
So I personally had planned to be in the kitchen, to help in the kitchen.
Oh, that's great.
My instincts told me that wasn't the kitchen for me. I have a huge presence, and the energy said, nah, that's not where we're supposed to go. So what I did is I actually, I did whatever I could when it was needed, if it was helping and supporting people around me. I kind of was like, well, if I'm not going to be, like, in the kitchen, what am I going to do? What do I do? That's like an awesome question. What did I do? Sometimes it was just making sure the camp was put together and that, you know, by the time you're done, like, brewing your coffee on the fire and getting, you know, it's 1:30 in the afternoon. So what are you doing? I shared a lot of stories with people. We were at a crossroads where our camp was. So people had to, we were at a fork. And so I met quite a few people, but what I, and, you know, when you tell stories, it's like an awesome way to connect with people. But, like, what are you really here to do? And that was my question, because I kept asking myself that as I was driving. What am I doing? You know, you can't go to the front lines because you can't afford to spend months in North Dakota dealing with court. And if you're going to end up in the front lines, you don't plead guilty. You stick it out, you know, because you're there for a reason. So what I did is I sort of listened to the wind, and I ended up supporting the International Indigenous Youth Council. One of the days I was there, I was shopping for provisions. It was raining pretty bad, and everybody was wet, and it was cold. So we were going to make sure that, you know, I spent my donation money to cover their warmth and getting them some provisions. So that took like a whole day. And I observed and I spent time with them to support, to learn how I could support them on the ground when I returned home, because I was so blown away by their tenacity, their energy, their desire to work beyond Standing Rock, No Dapple issues to support their communities. And so that became a big thing for me, was like, what can I do? One day we made a banner, which we keep seeing, the No Dapple Youth Council banner. We were like, you know, we had a plastic bag with some spray paint and a sponge, and that's what we used to make their sign. Well, you know, it's a plastic sign. We're actually making a new one to send out there. But it's, you know, you do whatever is necessary.
Let me ask you another question, which is, what is it that people could do from where they are elsewhere? What could they do? What could they send? You know, what would be helpful that, you know, more of us could do to support this?
So there are several ways that you can support financially. One of the things that's coming up now is that, you know, Standing Rock Reservation has basically, is basically hosting everyone. They're hosting everyone. They have to empty those porta potties every day. They have to take the garbage and deal. So a lot of their infrastructure costs are beginning to be dipped into just to support another town. So the Sacred Stone, a lot of stuff is happening on Facebook right now, and I'm not really sure why. I think it's just easiest to pop in, and that's where people are looking. So on Facebook, if you go to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, you will see continuous, there's an official fund for Standing Rock. They basically say, please consider making a donation as we prepare for winter. And the list at the moment that they're funding is food and meals, porta-johns, trash collection, hand-washing stations, community shelters, and tents. And so that's a definite. There's also, so the Sacred Stone Camp, everybody's basically preparing for winter. So Sacred Stone, sacredstonecamp.org mm-hmm. is another way that you can make donations. And the other one, that which is really where my heart is the mm-hmm. International Indigenous Youth Council, this Standing mm-hmm. Rock chapter. Mm-hmm. They are in the process of pulling together their ability to receive funds. These are young people. And that's one of the things I'm working on right now. We have just, we're pulling together a website for them, and we have a fiscal sponsor here in Woodstock, actually, I believe, who's going to begin collecting donations for them, and that is at the woodstockmuseum.org. They will begin collecting donations and will send them out and or do shops for them. For the moment, just to while they get situated.
Let me ask you, sure thing. Let me just ask you, as you're doing that, what is the what is the current situation, and what are they hoping to accomplish in staying there through the winter?
So, a few things. Basically, for one thing, from what I'm noticing, and I'm not going to tell, I can't speak for what their, you know, main purpose is, right? But mm-hmm. what I'm seeing is that, you know, there's a definite movement to sort of break up the party, so to speak. The sheriff mm-hmm. Of Morton County has reached out to the National Sheriff's Department to mm-hmm. invite sheriffs from other states. I recently saw a press conference that was like, really, you guys? They're like, we have to protect the community, and we need safety. Like, they're kind of, it's not true. There is not like a band of wild Comanches running over the hill with cops. You know, that's not the case. These people are coming in prayer. So, the point of sticking it out through the winter is that you know what happens when everybody goes to bed, everybody goes back mm-hmm. to sleep. As mm-hmm. soon as we turn our eyes, they slide in another way. That's exactly what happened, and this is what brings me back when Obama, many people think, ordered a stop mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. of construction. But actually, he asked for them to stop in a nice way. That's actually what happened. Mm-hmm. And then he told us, hey, mm-hmm. we hear you, man. We hear you. We're still with you. And that brings me right back to Obama's election. And I bet mm-hmm. you remember this. He was elected. The next day, we found out that I found out that he was going to put Tom Vilsack in as the head of the FDA, yes. and Tom Vilsack is like right out of Monsanto, and like within yep. a minute, 250,000 people, hundreds of thousands of people said, don't do that. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands of people. And he said, oh, I hear you. You know what? Mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands of people. We're going to reconsider this. And everyone went, oh, shoot, that's awesome. 2 weeks later, boom, he's in. Vacation is
and he's been in the whole time. He's been in the whole time. He had a lot to do with the recent passage of a bill that completely obscures, confuses, if not kills, the labeling movement, the GMO labeling movement. And mm-hmm. he is the chairman or the head of Hillary Clinton's transition team. So, you know, and was considered as a potential vice presidential candidate. So, yeah, I mean, when you hear, I hear you, or you know, or talking points, I think we have to really get more savvy, especially, I mean, you know, Obama personally was a highly charismatic individual, but, you know, we really have to get more discerning, mm-hmm. and you know, that's an excellent point. It's had a long-standing and still continuing effect on worsening the food supply. So, yeah, Tom Vilsack, I do remember it very clearly.
yeah. mm-hmm. And so that, you know, so that's what, in order to show the importance and the actual, this isn't really like, it's not a game.
It's, we're here. We set this. We're here to keep the awareness wide open about what's happening. And that's part of, you know, that's why you hear, like, we need bodies. We need people to spend time with us and to, and who's in it for the winter. You know, if there's three people there, what statement is that going to make? What, how much, it's easy to move three people out of an encampment. You can't move 3,000 people out of an encampment easily. And it's, this is, I think this, one of the things that's happening here is that there are nations coming together who, and we talked about this last time we spoke, that everybody's coming from a front line. So a lot of people do need to go home. I had to go home. We're working on what's happening here in New York. But it's unifying communities that this is becoming a global village. Yes, it's the third, or what is it, the 17th largest city in North Dakota right now. Like, it's they've, like, marked it as, like, you know, it's a small city. But in actuality, this is becoming a global community of Native solidarity. And the allies, we're sticking it out for the winter because we're sticking it out. And I think there's a lot of conversation about treaty law. And maybe this relationship we've been having all these years isn't a healthy one. I mean, we figured that out. But, you know, it's like, if we're supposed to sit here and wait for you to tell us what's okay and what's not okay, then we're not autonomous, are we?
Well, you know, I don't know if you, I mean, I think part of the question is, are the Native tribes supposed to have this level of independence where they really can self-determine about this, or is this a kind of fiction?
Yeah, and, you know, supposed to, right? Like, for you and I know that they are supposed to. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, in our minds and our hearts, we know they should have autonomy if that's what they want. But what have we done to these communities, and where have we brought them, and where is this, their strength? It's in their spirit, because everything else we've pretty much stripped from them, and then we're like, oh, here, take a little something. So, supposed to, that's a hard question. It's a hard question.
Well, no, I mean, what is the legality? Because I would think that, you know, I don't know that this is an area of understanding in terms of the history with Native Americans and their rights. I wouldn't say that's something that, that, you know, maybe everyone's familiar with. So I'm
right. Got it.
You know.
Okay. So yes, they should have. They should be able to make sovereign decisions about the health, self, safety, well-being of their communities. I mean, according to treaties and agreements that were made. You know, I think it's the 1870 Laramie Treaty. These treaties are, you know, agreements for us to allow these communities to handle their own governance, to and to have a voice in what happens in their communities. And time and time and time and time and time again, we have broken and are breaking and just totally disregard treaty law. And so that's where that question, are they supposed to? I think according to treaty law, they have rights.
Mm-hmm.
But according to U.S. government law, they don't. So where does that conversation, and that's a conversation that I can't even fully dig into, but I could definitely, you know, connect you with people who can talk about that at length and in depth. But I think that the question here is, how is the, as what we've come to call American government, going to show up here? And pretty much they're like, they're dancing around it. And when I saw this sheriff's press conference the other day, they said, are you looking at federal, you know, intervention? And are you looking at the National Guard coming in stronger? And he's going, no, because I don't think that I think that the federal government's kind of trying to just really, like, placate over here and push it into a local problem. And that's, you know, when do we actually show up and say it's time to say no And this would be an awesome opportunity for Obama to, like, go out vetoing another massively destructive pipeline. Like he did with the Keystone XL. This is the Keystone 2. Say no. It's the least he could do.
Of course, if he says no, and then the TPP passes, then that
right.
region is subject to lawsuits. I mean, that's the other, you know, kind of
yeah.
horror thing lurking in the background of all of this as well. But, and also, since he's promoting the TPP, you know, it's fairly clear where his actual
right.
allegiance lies. So, A, if he did what you suggest, it would be kind of playing a misleading double game. And if he's consistent, it's unlikely that he'll do it. So,
right.
you know, this has the makings of an impasse. And I think that creates the argument that the people who have nobly gathered there and put themselves on the line in that community and are planning to stay through a cold winter are really fighting everyone's battle. You know, they're the true warriors. And so, I, you know, in doing that, and it's not easy, and it's not easy, feasible, or maybe even all that helpful for, you know, a lot of us to go packing out there unless we, you know, some will have the calling to do that. I would never discourage that either because I'm sure they,
right.
you know, could benefit from some backup numbers at that time. But, you know, anyone who's fighting any environmental issue really has to look upon this as their fight. And yet, how many people actually know about this? I have had conversations, you know, both with other non-red Americans as well as natives who are really, or
mm-hmm.
people with native blood, because many people do have native blood. You know, many people are not aware of this because of the mainstream
right.
media blackout. So another thing that I would also say to listeners here on Connect the Dots is, you know, let other people know. Tell them about it. Go to social media. Go to Rachel Marco Haven's Facebook page. Go to the Facebook pages that Rachel follows and recommends. Come to my page, Connecting the Dots for Health, you know, and follow some of those postings and share them with other people because, you know, with the presidential election as well and all the drama that has happened, that will happen, you know, that will be coming to play over the next months, with the passage of the TPP, there are going to be a lot of things that are going to make tend to push this into the background as an issue. But with the corruption that we have in government, you know, it may be one of our best stands because, you know, we may not have, or the power of our vote may not be what we hoped. The choice of candidates may not be what people hope. You know, we're fighting the passage of the TPP. You know, politicians are, as we know, through Money in Politics and Citizens United bought. But this is really an impasse, and we, you know, that presents an opportunity, and, you know, and you know, we kind of draw the line in the sand. So I think it's really important for people, whether it's the climate issue or any other issue of money in politics or any, in, you know, other environmental issue with fracking that, you know, or food that, or water rights that draws you or speaks to you, you know, you could really regard the No DAPL fight at Standing Rock, which you, Rachel, have, you know, spent this quality time with and having this experience that you're sharing with our listeners today. You know, they're really standing for all of us as the native inhabitants of this land. And, you know, so I, you know, I strongly urge everyone to stand with them. It's, you know, beautiful and important thing. And it's wonderful to have this report as well because it's not easy for people to go out there, and it's not people because of the downed phone lines and all the work involved in this, maintaining this and everything else. It's not even easy for those whom we know out there, because I know through my whole environmental network people out there, it's not easy for them to be reaching us and putting out their stories or to have the time. I mean, I know through friends who were organizers on this front in that area and in adjacent states, you know, this is like, it's been 24/7 for some people. It's been unrelenting, you know, and I think that may have eased up a bit, but, you know, but this is not like a hang out in the country kind of moment thing. It's like,
I would encourage you to follow up with all of them, because I'm telling you, there's going to be thousands of different perspectives. And of course we look at the world and everybody's got a perspective, but in this particular situation, I think we're going to be unpacking a lot for a long time. What I mean by unpacking this for a long time is that the different people that have come to this land, you know, the prophecies say, if you land here, there's a reason you got something to do. I figured out my reason was to support the young people. I kind of knew that. But everybody's going to have a different take as yes, the world, but I think there's going to be a lot for us to learn on many levels, spiritually, actively. There's a lot for us to learn from this, and we really do need to turn back and look at our communities, because as the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, as they call them, protection zone escalated, Obama okayed the same company for two pipelines to Mexico, the Trans-Pecos, and you know, so this is happening. This is, you can support the No DAPL community by supporting at home, because sometimes some of you are going to find this oil is going right through your backyard too.
Yeah.
So it's like local, global.
No, that's
global,
a really good,
global,
so we
local.
Can fight local, local, global. I love that. Well, we're coming to the end of our time here on Connect the Dots, and I just want to thank you again, Rachel Marco Havens, for your second visit with me and our listeners to educate us and share your experience. It's been, again, a total pleasure having you on the show. You know, best wishes, and we'll stay in touch with you and all your ongoing and terrific work with young people and in environmental activism. Listeners, you know, please check out Rachel's website, Rachel Marco Havens, as well as her Facebook page, and you know, stay tuned and stay informed as all this continues to unfold. Thank you. So, and if you like this show, please do share it. You can share it on iTunes. You can link to it as an MP3. You know, after you've enjoyed it, it will show up within a day or so at Connect the Dots Podbean. And thank you for once again being with me and our guests here on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Have a great week and be well.
And there was day and there was night, and there was dark and there was light. There was the earth, there was the sky, and there in the tree that crawled alive. Umma wele.